Sunday, August 18th at 11 p.m., Sugar in My Bowl will present drummer, composer, and instructor Michael Carvin. Join us as we discuss his life in music as a practitioner and teacher. That's Sunday, August 18th at 11 p.m., right here on WBAI New York, 99.5 FM, and WBAI.org on the web.
WBAI New York, 99.5 FM. Sugar in My Bowl is the name of this program. Our guest this evening is Michael Carvin.
Hi, Hank.
Hi, Joyce.
And Hank Williams is here, our associate producer and behind blog. Oh God, our blogger, our web guy, and well, there'll be more coming up.
Much more. Stay tuned.
Some steam on my clothes. Maybe I can fix things up so they'll go. What's the matter, Daddy? Come on, save my soul. I want some sugar in my bowl. I ain't fooling. I want some sugar. My boat.
Hi, my name's Joyce Jones, and I'm sitting in this lovely diner with
Michael Carvin.
Michael Carvin, thank you so much for joining Sugar and My Bowl on the road.
All right, then. This is great. It's a gorgeous day, isn't it?
It is. Yeah, it's a beautiful day to be in the diner.
Yeah, the stage door diner.
That's right. Yeah. We've done diners before on Sugar.
Oh, yeah.
Thank you so much for joining
You're welcome, George. You're welcome.
Now, I want to start from the beginning.
Okay.
For you. I understand you were born in Houston, Texas.
Yes.
Is that true?
Yes.
What was the music like there for you growing up?
It was great. It was a lot of fun because everybody could play. I mean, my father went to high school with Arnett Cobb and Illinois Cadet, and Alex Sample is Joe Sample's oldest brother that played organ, that taught Joe how to play piano. Also, Uncle Don Roby, who owned Peacock Records. He was my middle brother, godfather. So, of course, everybody in Texas is Uncle This and Uncle That. So it was great for me to go and hear a young Bobby Blue Bland. Sam Cooke, well, I didn't hear Sam, but I heard some of the records when he was singing gospel, because they recorded at Peacock Records with Lou Rawls and Isaac Hayes singing background with Sam Cooke gospel group, and Johnny Clyde Copeland, guitar, blues singer. His daughter now is getting very big.
Shamika Copeland.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Now, I remember her when she was a little one, and I worked with Johnny Clyde. I was about 13, 14. Mm. And Albert Defrost Collins, when he had that first hit record, Defrost.
Oh, okay.
And everybody called him in Texas, Albert Defrost Collins. You know? And then we had the Palladium Ballroom was our equivalent to your parlor theater.
Mm.
But the music scene was great. I was very lucky because I started playing drums at 6 years old. But I was the drum captain in junior high school and senior high school. So that meant that during that time in Texas, the prettiest girls in school were the majorettes and the cheerleaders. You can be a majorette and cheerleader if you weren't pretty in Texas.
Yeah. Especially in Texas.
Yeah, so the drum captain have to meet with both. I have to meet with the head majorette so she'll know what kind of signal I'm going to play on the drums to stop and start the band. I have to meet with the head cheerleader so when they were write out new yells, what beat to put on it. Like one of the first beats that I arranged, which I didn't know I was arranging then, that I was actually dealing with early orchestration, but I didn't realize it then. They had a cheer called We Did It Once and We Can Do It Again. So come on, boys, and let's go. Beat Wheatley, because Phyllis Wheatley was one of our team. So I listened to it, so I'd say, we did it once and we can do it again. So come on, boys, and let's go. Beat Wheatley. That's when I realized the power of the drum. It got to the point in the grandstand during the football game where I could just play. And they would say,
Beat Wheatley.
And that's when I realized the power of language through the drums.
Right.
And I grew up in segregation, which was really great for one reason, for what was going on in Mississippi and Atlanta, Georgia, and all of that. Now, a lot of people said it was going on in the state of Texas, but I can only speak the way I was raised.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't see it. What I hear of an incident here and there, of course I would. But what I saw was Africa and Texas. Everybody, because my father was a successful entrepreneur, he was a drummer, and he also owned the Carvin and Son Jose Beer Company. Henry Carvin Sr. When I was born, I pulled him off the road. He was with Louis Armstrong, and my mom said, well, hey, we got three hard heads now. Well, that's what he called us. You have to come home. But he was cool about it. After he had built a name in Texas, local name, playing drums, he opened up a Carvin and Son wholesale beer distributing company. So the clubs that he would play in, he would have them to buy beer from him. Ain't that something?
Okay.
So the beer would be delivered on Thursday, because keep in mind, Texas was a dry state. You can't sell nothing on Sunday. So the beer would be delivered on Thursday, wholesale. The guys would back their trucks up on Friday. By 2 o'clock on Saturday afternoon, it would be empty. Yeah. Saturday, he put the lock on the door. It would be empty.
Now, Mr. Carvin Sr. taught you how to drum,
what, 6? Oh, yeah. Yeah, I started reading at 6.
Oh, okay.
I resented my father. I hated him. I couldn't stand him. I couldn't stand him. Because I wanted to play the drums like he did. And he would leave a set of drums set up in the living room. And I'd say, well, Dada, can I play the drums? He'd say, well, you don't know how. And that pissed me off. But I was born with common sense. That's good and bad. So I understood it. He said, when you learn how to play the drum, I'll buy you a set of drums. Well, I didn't want to hear that at 6 years old.
Right.
And everybody else playing their drums, and I go to school, and everybody got their drums. But out of all the drummers that I was in high school with, I'm the only one that turned professional. For one reason, I was never a banger.
Mm.
See, had he let me raise me, I probably wouldn't be a master drummer today. Why? Because who in their right mind at 6 years old want discipline?
No 6 year old.
No, right? Right?
Right.
Especially when he had me hitting his practice pad and I ain't getting no sound and
right.
The drums are sitting there and.
Right.
You know, I hated him. I couldn't stand him. He was the worst thing that ever breathed. When I won my first rudimental competition at 12, I'd say, ah, so that's what he was doing. See, once you win, all is forgiven. Everything becomes clear. See, I love to win, and after that, everything is clear. That's what I teach my young, great drummers. Every student that I've ever had, and I don't teach beginners.
Now, by beginners, what do you mean?
You have to be at least 21 and have made, hopefully, at least one record or two. Then I know you're serious.
Okay.
I don't teach for the money. Of course, I have to make money to pay for my studio, but I teach to make drummers. All of my students, when they first come to me, there's one thing that I know, and I just tell them straight off the bat. Tell me the books you've been studying out of, and they'll say this book and that book, and I'll say, you didn't finish any of them. And they said, that's right. I said, I know it's right. Because if you would have finished them, you would have learned how to finish. And if you would have learned how to finish, you wouldn't be standing before me now.
Mm. Now, I want to talk about your being a teacher slash coach. Because I understand you don't particularly care for teachers.
No, can't nobody teach nobody nothing. But it really can.
However, you do have a slogan, each one.
Oh, yeah, each one teach one, yeah.
That's right. I mean,
yeah.
Most people, you know, that it's not a new, you didn't come up with it, but it is
no,
something that you
no,
definitely
Chinese.
Practice. Yeah.
It's China, yeah. Each one teach one.
Yeah.
Yeah. I've been practicing that for over 50 years. Yeah.
At what age did you wind up gigging?
When I was 13, I joined Carl Campbell's rhythm section. It was Carl Campbell Trio. And that's when I learned all the standards because Carl Campbell's whole life was built around Nat King Cole. He played piano and sang. So anything Nat did, we would do it. And that's how I learned all of the standards. So my parents said to say, look, as long as you keep up your grades, you can play. So at 13, I really started understanding what school was really about. This for anybody that's listening to me out there in radio land, if you want to have a great education. When you go to school, it's only two grades, A or F. Because in life, it's either you winning or losing. Don't nobody live no B life or no C-plus life or no D-minus life. Come on now. Now, look, it's either you taking care of yourself or you not. You don't have to take no teacher, no Apple or Grin or none of that. You ain't got to do none of that. The only thing you have to do is do what the teacher tell you to do. No more and no less. Why? Why? Because the whole concept of young people going to school is to learn how to function in the workplace, to basically take orders and to carry them out without poking your mouth out or have to be told over and over and over and over and over. So once I figured that out, because I had to in order to work with Carl Campbell, once I figured that out, I was good. And most of my teachers I would see in the club because I worked six nights a week. It's kind of different when your teacher turn around and you're the one playing the beat to make them dance.
How did you get to the point where you were good enough to work with Hampton Holmes?
Well, that was my first jazz gig. And like I teach my young, great drummers, we stumble into success. Success is not a premeditated thing. You'll be going in one direction, you're running to something, you'll stumble, and you'll end up going in a different direction. Okay, so Donald Bailey, drummer that made all those famous Jimmy Smith records. Okay, Donald Bailey had moved to Los Angeles, California. He was working with Hampton Hawes and Charlie Hayden. So Donald, we call him Duck. So Donald Duck put a band together with young musicians. The drummer was Michael Carvin. And Donna Bailey plays trombone and harmonica. So we rehearsing. We didn't play any gigs, but we rehearsing. So Duck told me, he said, look, man, Ham just asked me to go to Europe with him, and it's not paying enough money for me to take it. He said, but I would like for you to go because you have never played jazz, and this would be a good way to get out there with a trio and kind of get your feet wet. And he said, you'll be playing all the major festivals so everybody will get a chance to hear you. That's how I got with Hampton Hall. So if I hadn't been with Donald's band, I wouldn't have gotten the Hampton band.
Well, how old were you when you did that?
25.
Oh, okay. How was it working with Hampton Hall?
Hampton Hall was a sweetheart. I admired him, but I wasn't ready for Hampton Hall because I have too much energy. And I love Hampton, and I must have been like a tornado in his presence. But the first gig we played was in Switzerland, in Zurich. And that's when we recorded live, Hampton Hall in Zurich, Switzerland, 1971. And the MC, I guess he saw me moving about the concert grounds, because when he introduced me, if you go and listen to the record, he's saying on the batterie, the drums, it's Michael Hurricane Carvin.
Nous avons pu obtenir ceci surtout grâce à l'appui de Monsieur Madame Ginibre, et surtout de Jack Lewerke. You see, Jack, I want to thank you because you helped us to get the Hampton Hawes over, Hampton Hawes Trio over. Nous avons le plaisir ce soir de vous présenter un pianiste qui certainement sera pour beaucoup d'entre vous une très grande découverte ce soir, d'autant plus qu'il est accompagné par deux magnifiques musiciens. Tout d'abord, le bassiste Henry Franklin et le batteur Michael Hurricane Carvin. Voici le Hampton Hawes Trio. Hampton Hawes. Hampton Hawes.
So were you with Jackie McLean right after you left Hampton Hawes?
Let me see, 71. No, Freddie Hubbard.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. Well, see, what happened was I was with Hampton Hawes in 71. I was still living in Los Angeles. Now, after I finished the tour with Hampton Hawes, I had made up my mind that I was going to go to New York, and I wasn't going to do the pop thing anymore. During that time, what year was that, 1971, from 1968 to 1970, I was with Motown. So 1971, I was left Motown. Yeah, I finished with Hamp. I came back from the tour was from June the 1st to September the 15th. So then I came back. I sold my car, Joyce. I moved to San Francisco. Why? Why? Because I never lived in a city because coming from Houston to L.A. is the same. Just with palm trees, and you can eat in restaurants.
Uh-huh.
Other than that, it's the same.
Wow.
So I moved to San Francisco. I had gone out of practice, George, for 2 years. I was going to practice from 1971 to 1973. Then I was going to go to New York. So I heard Freddie Hubbard's Red Clay. Rootum pop, pop. I said, oh, I can play that. Because that's my Motown and pop stuff. You know, Intrepid Fox was a hit.
Right.
That was a big record for Freddie.
Right.
So I'm listening to that little pop, pop, salute to pop, pop. I said, oh, yeah. See, because prior to that, I was at Max and Art Bacon, Lightning and Thunder, mm-hmm. and tempos.
Yeah.
And make my arm want to run away from my torso. And,
right.
you know. And when I heard that, I said, I can do that. So I went and bought the record, and I transcribed it, the whole record. I wrote out the drum part.
Okay.
And I made up my mind my target was going to be Freddie Hubbard. I knew, George, he was going to give me one shot, because the way I looked at it, he don't know me. Oh, we made 5 records on the Hampton Hawes tour.
Right.
But none of them came out until 1986.
Oh, okay.
So nobody still heard that,
right.
that didn't hear it live.
I see.
So I started working on the book, the Both and Club, Both and Jazz Club was right here, was owned by Delano Dean. So I've always had a lot of energy, so I would get up in the morning and I would go for my walk, and I would see Delano in there cleaning up the club by himself. So I would go in and help him clean up the club for free. I would take the glasses off and, you know, sweep. And,
right.
and he would have these records playing because I didn't know nothing about jazz. So he would have these records playing. I would say, man, who is that? And he said, that's so-and-so-and-so. And I said, who is that? He said, that's so-and-so-and-so. So I would go every morning and help him clean the club so I could listen to his records.
Now, wait a minute. You said you had already known about Max Roach. And
yeah, but I hadn't really heard that type of situation like a Max and Abby.
Oh.
The name, yes, because right. of Charlie Parker.
Right.
I knew that in Texas. But I didn't hear them play because they didn't come to Texas and they didn't sell that kind of music.
Okay.
See, to hear somebody's name and then get into their work is two different things.
Oh, yeah.
And Delano was just, he said, man, Bobby Hutcherson is looking for a drummer. Won't you hook up with Bobby? I said, man, I don't want to play with anybody because I had some money and I came here to practice. I'm very stubborn. I'm very stubborn. And I would just come by and check out the New York bands because Delano hired all of the New York bands because after the Blackhawk closed, although I wasn't in San Francisco, then the Both and took that crowd.
Okay.
So everybody worked there, Freddie, everybody, Miles, everybody. So I would like check out the bands and I could get in free. So I would just come and just listen. I wouldn't say anything to anybody. I didn't want to meet anybody. So Delano said, well, man, why won't you let me introduce you to some of the guys? I say, I don't want to meet them. He said, why? I said, because it's not time. I just want to listen. And what I was doing was studying their ways and habits, because I'd never been around jazz musicians. I'd been around pop guys and television people. It's a whole other situation.
Right. And before we continue, clarify for everybody, you said you've done pop stuff, and you were playing with Motown. And
oh, yeah, yeah.
And you were doing what in television?
The Bobby McMahon TV show in Los Angeles, yeah. And I also had the opening act with Richard Pryor for 2 years.
Okay.
I also had the opening act with Bill Cosby, which I had a trio, guitar, bass, and drums. I did all of the arrangement, pop stuff. We would do an hour, would take an intermix, and then Richard would do an hour. That was it. The same thing with Cosby.
Okay.
So
back to Freddie.
Yeah. So Delano said, man, you know, man, once you play, man, once you play and cats can hear you. So I came by there one night, Bobby was working. So Delano said, man, come on, man, and meet him. So I said, okay. Bobby was a sweetheart, too. Bobby's just gorgeous, gorgeous. So I really like Bobby. I mean, I really did.
No, I understand.
As a person.
He's a great person.
As a person.
Very sweet.
Oh, he's just like Hampton Hogs was the same way, very fragile.
Mm-hmm.
So I dug him, and I never played with a mallet player.
Mm-hmm.
And what I realized was that when I made the first rehearsal with him, I realized that I had to play my fills a different way for one reason, because both of us are using the same muscles, which was kind of weird because a piano player is this way, but Bobby is actually phrasing. He's using the same muscle, and he's playing his instrument the same as I'm playing mine.
Right.
So in order for me to accompany him or to set him up to make him sound good, I have to be really in tune to what his sticking is in order to enhance what he's playing.
Right.
Once I realized I couldn't do that, I was in, because it was a challenge.
Okay.
I was in then.
Yeah.
Because here's something to learn
right.
that you don't know nothing about.
Right.
Man, Bobby opened me up to so much, man. So, I've been with Bobby about a year. So, around 1972, the end of 1972, Delano Dean said, man, I'm going to have Bobby to play New Year's Eve. He said, I want to bring somebody from New York to hear you. Who would you like for me to bring? This is what Delano Dean did for me. I said, bring Jackie McLean. He said, okay, I'm going to call Jackie and see if he'll do it. See, and I didn't know that Jackie had already made that Gracian Moncar III record with Bobby DaCosta record. But see, I wasn't hip to that because I hadn't got the Gracian yet. So, yeah, see, I'm learning. So Jackie said yes. So that New Year's Eve, Freddie was at the Greater Music Theater in San Francisco. And Herbie was at the Ice Palace because he had just put that sextet together.
N1Disha.
Yeah, and he had that record out.
Oh, okay.
N1Disha. They was at the Ice Palace. Okay. Now, I didn't realize that Herbie and Freddie had played with Bobby and Jackie, but I didn't know.
Right,
see,
because you're still learning.
I didn't know.
Right.
I didn't know. I knew Herbie recorded Watermelon Man, and he worked with Miles.
Right.
But I didn't know, you know, he was on the Gracian stuff. You know,
right.
I didn't know.
Right.
So we went from 10 to 4. So they played their concert. So they all came by to see Jackie and Bobby. They got a chance to hear me. I didn't say nothing to them, though.
Why not?
Because that's just the way I am.
Okay.
And when Freddie and Herbie came in the dressing room, I walked out.
You wanted to be courted?
No. I didn't want Freddie to have no reference. You know what I'm saying?
Mm-hmm.
Because I was building my strategy to attack him.
Oh, okay.
And I didn't want no familiarity between he and I. I didn't want him to say, yeah, man, you was the drummer that was working with Bobby at the... I didn't want no reference. I didn't, and I knew he wasn't going to remember who I was because he was having a good time. So it was perfect for me. Because when you are building your strategy to attack, you can't let nobody know that you're coming. No, I didn't want it to be courted. I wanted to do exactly what I did.
Okay.
I wanted to take him down.
Okay.
So, you know, I watched this mannerism. Keep in mind, I'm a Vietnam veteran, so I'm dealing with military strategy.
Mm, okay.
And I didn't want, I'm your pal, or let's be buddies. I don't like that type of relationship with band leaders, because that doesn't work for me. So, I knew I had him, but I'm watching his mannerism off the bandstand, and I said, okay, then, once I get the gig, not if, I got to give him his space. Because we are two different individuals. And this is business.
Okay.
So I worked harder, working on the book harder. So he came back to town about 3 months later to play the BA, the both band. So I went on a Tuesday night and I listened to the first set, and I would leave just before they took the break, and I would go home because I only live around the corner, because I didn't want him to connect with my face or nothing. Then I could stand outside and hear them when they started. You know, the club is packed. And I would just come and stand against the back wall. Now, he was playing the Red Clay book. So I wasn't listening to what they were playing. I was studying how he hear and from what music. See, each band leader have one instrument that he favors.
Yes.
So I knew if he... after he took his solo, if he went and stood on the piano side, that means he's really into harmonics.
But he loved the drums.
Exactly.
He didn't get the drums.
Exactly. He would go around and stand on Lenny White hi-hat. So I said, okay, he's into the drum. Then shortly after he left, I heard Art Blakey record with him on it. Of course, I was hip to Art Blakey, but it was Lee Morgan was my man. And I didn't hear, or maybe I was hearing Freddie and didn't know it, but I was in the league, period. So once I found out he came out of Blake, I said, I got him. He listened to the drummer for his energy and his direction. So I said, I got him. So I say, now, I have to say something to him, Joyce, that is so profound that I have to stop him dead in his tracks. Or why is he going to give me a shot? I don't live in New York. I've never played with any of the New York cats on the scene. So why is he going to give me a shot? And he's hot as a firecracker. After the last night, I came up to him as soon as he walked off the bandstand. I say, Freddie, if you want to sound good, you should hire me. And I turned around and walked out of the club because I knew where his ego was at.
So what, did he follow you?
No.
Oh, did he call you?
No, I didn't give him my phone number. That's all I said.
So how?
He left San Francisco, went to the Lighthouse. Howard runs the Lighthouse in L.A. I just moved from L.A. I've been there for 10 years. I had all kind of places to stay. I flew down to L.A. I took the red eye on Wednesday night. I watched the first set. I walked out, came back, the same thing. After the gig, I told him, if you want to sound good, you should hire me. I turned around and walked out because I had his itinerary. I drove from L.A. to San Diego with my partner. Same thing. When he saw me in San Diego, he said, hey, man, he said, you must like me. You followed me. You know, Freddie. I said, if you want to sound good, you should hire me. And he said, who are you? I said, my name is Michael Carter. He said, okay, then, come and set in. I said, no. He said, well, why not? I said, because the emotion of where the band is at right now is nothing I can do to blend with that. Because you guys have already created a situation, if it's good or not. I say, Lenny White drums is there for Lenny White. Mm-hmm. I say, Freddie, you're going to give me one shot, man. I want to put my best foot forward. I say, but I'll bring my drums anywhere you tell me, anytime you want me to. And then, if I don't do it, then at least you let me put my best foot forward. He looked at me and said, give me your number, man. And I gave it to him. And I left. 3 weeks later, he called me. He said, meet me at the Vanguard. You got the gig.
Wow.
So I flew from L.A. I checked in at the Wellington Hotel. Went to the Vanguard. I played the first gig. But what happened during the first set, I almost freaked out. Because I'm playing and I felt the bandstand do this.
Oh, it was unstable. It was shaking.
And I'm saying, it's an earthquake. To myself.
Right.
I say, oh, my God. It's
like
New York. It's the 7th Avenue train. But I didn't know. After the set, I'm scared to death. So I tell Junior Cook, I say, Junior, did you feel that, man? That was an earthquake. Junior said, earthquake? He said, man, he said, that's a subway.
Yeah.
I never been on no subway. I ain't know that Houston ain't have no subway. So after the first night, Freddie said, man, how do you know my music so well? See, because these guys, this is what I teach my young, great drummers. If you're going to join an act on this level, you get one shot, Joyce. And they are going to rehearse you and hold your hand. You know who I am. You said you wanted to play with me. 1, 2, 3, 4. And I said, I told you, Freddie, if you want to sound good, you should hire me. So the next day I say, Hub, I need to get a haircut. He said, great. And he said, I'm going to get one, too. He took me to Brooklyn. He introduced me to Dwayne, his son.
Oh, yeah.
Dwayne and I and Freddie went to get a haircut. Yeah, and I got to see that side of him.
Yeah.
And I laid with my original strategy. On the road, I get off the we finish the gig. Mm-hmm. Freddie go out that door. I'm going out of this one. Well, we left the Vanguard and went to Europe for a month. That's when we ended up doing the French radio. We'll be right back.
shows have DVDs. It's called Freddie Hubbard Live in France, 1973.
Yeah, so we had been out there for about 2 weeks, so he started calling me preacher. He said, "Hey, preacher." I said, "Man, why you call me preacher?" He said, "Because you don't do nothing." I said, "Okay." I love Freddie. Freddie, in my opinion, is a sir and a gentleman and a first-class human being because he gave me a shot and he didn't have to. But that was the only way that I could get Freddie to hear me because I couldn't come like, "Oh, Mr. Hubbard, I'm with you," you know, or like, "Yeah, man, well, you know," because that's his. I had to be so profound and so consistent and persistent. I had to drive him to one conclusion, either this cat is a complete nut or he can do what he's telling me. That's what I tell my students, like, every student that had left me that had wanted to join a certain band, we have never missed with all of them. I teach them how. This particular blueprint worked because you're doing your homework. You see, in order to join a guy's band or a lady's band and you know they book, that's a compliment. You care that much about me, you care that much about my music, that you have taken the time out in your life and time to study my book, well, I'll be a fool. That was really a great experience. But see, Jackie had told me when he came to San Francisco to play that gig in 72, he said, "Look, if you ever come to New York, call me, man, and I'll hire you." Well, I wanted to hold that card because Jackie had just left Avenue C and Jackie and Dolly had just got the house in Hartford, Connecticut, and Jackie had just got the tenure at the University of Hartford. So I knew that Jackie wasn't going to be moving around as much, so I wanted to kind of run off of my Freddie Hubbard exposure. So once you enter certain musical families, then other guys in that family hire you. So when Eric Kabat left McCoy called me. And and once I joined that family, then Pharoah, then Alice Coltrane, well, Jimmy Garrison before he died. See, because it's like a certain families, and once one person of that family adopt you, then that means that the other people in the family becomes your family. So I was working a lot with everybody, and then I ran into Costona, and I started doing studio work, and then. I wanted to work with Dizzy, but I wanted to work with Dizzy last because he's the innovator. And after Dizzy, I wasn't going to be a side man anymore. And that's what I did.
And that's when you decided to record the Camel.
Listening to WBAI New York 99.5 FM. Sugar My Bowl is the name of this program. Our guest for this evening is Michael Carvin. Master drummer Michael Carvin. I left that out in the promo. Don't let it be misunderstood. As you can hear, Michael Carvin is indeed a master drummer. Isn't that right, Hank?
That's right.
Yeah. And what we're listening to right now is the song that I used on the promo. It is called The Camel. It's the title cut. It was written by Michael Carvin, and it's from a Steeplechase 1975 release. It's Michael Carvin on drums, Cecil Bridgewater on trumpet and flugelhorn, Sonny Fortune, we're talking over right now, he's on alto and soprano sax, Ron Burton on piano, and Calvin Hill on bass. Before that, we heard Intrepid Fox. It was an audio excerpt from the DVD Freddie Hubbard Live in France, 1973, and that's the Michael Carvin drum solo. Of course, Freddie Hubbard on trumpet, Junior Cook on tenor sax, George Cables on electric piano, and Kent Brinkley on bass. It is a Mosaic 2012 release.
Yes, it is.
There was something you wanted to add to that here?
If there
We have the playlist up on the website as we speak at sugarinmybowl.org/playlist.
And we also have a longer excerpt of that video, from that video of Michael Carvin's drum solo.
Yes, we do. If you go to go to our website, the first thing on the page is tonight's show with Michael Carvin, and we have a really nice embedded YouTube video where you can actually see them. You can actually see Hubbard's band live in '73. It's fantastic. Must
and you
watch.
Get to hear, you get to see Hubbard, and from what I'm told from Michael Carvin, they are wearing their street clothes. So it's like they are fly. Oh my gosh, they are wearing the best outfits. Anyway, before that, we heard This Guy's in Love with You. This Guy's in Love with You, the backrack song. And it included an intro where he, Michael Carvin was introduced as Michael Hurricane Carvin. Hampton Hawes, and that was the title cut from this release. It was originally recorded in 1971 and released on a Live in Montreux release. This is a 2010 reissue. And it's Hampton Hawes on piano, Henry Franklin on bass, and Michael Carvin on drums. Before that, we heard Nails, Nails to Michael Carvin. It was written by one of the band members, Claudio Rodigi. From Each One Teach One, Michael Carvin's Each One Teach One, produced by Houston Person and Michael Carvin. Michael Carvin on drums, Antoine Roney on tenor saxophone, Claudio Rodigi on trumpet, and as I mentioned, the composer of the song, Carlton Holmes on piano, David Williams on bass, and this is a 1994 Muse Records release. Before that, we heard our title, our song, our theme, I Want a Little Sugar in My Bowl, Nina Simone, from a compilation, The Very Best of Nina Simone, Sugar in My Bowl, 1967-1972. It's was originally recorded in 1967, and this is a 1998 RCA BMG compilation. And, you know, you just need to get yourself a copy of The Camel if you want to hear this without all our chatter, because it is time for Behind the Mic.
Good evening, jazz fans. This is Hank Williams, and this section of the show is The Bandstand, where we spotlight upcoming New York City area of shows of past Sugar in My Bowl guests. And we also have this online at the Sugar in My Bowl blog. You go to our main website, sugarinmybowl.org, and click on the link for the blog if you miss anything here. So, to begin with, we have a few shows coming up this week as the summer winds down. The Billy Hart Quartet will be at New York City's Birdland from August 20th to 24th. Go to birdlandjazz.com for more details. That is birdlandjazz.com. Drummer Kim Thompson will be leading a group at Harlem's Marcus Garvey Park on Saturday the 24th as part of the Charlie Parker Jazz Festival. All of that is free. Saturday's set runs from 3 to 7 and also has performances by Kenny Garrett, Cecile McLaurin-Salvant, and Jaleel Shaw. And the festival runs the entire weekend from Friday to Sunday, the 23rd to 25th. Thompson will also be part of a discussion of the film The Girls in the Band about female jazz and big band instrumentalists at the New School's Jazz and Performance Space on August 22nd from 6:30 to 8:30. That's part of the Parker Jazz Fest also. And City Parks Foundation website at cityparksfoundation.org has the full lineup and details of all the events. And you definitely want to catch some of that if you can. Sugar guest and host of our special, The Journey, Bobby Sanabria, will be appearing with Quartetto Ache at Newport Tower in Jersey City, New Jersey, for a lunchtime concert from noon to 2 on August 21st. He'll also be hearing with Larry Harlow and the Latin Legends Big Band for a free concert as part of the Summer Stage Series on August 29th at 7 p.m., You can see summerstage.org for details of this and the rest of their concerts this season. And Lakeisha Benjamin will appear one night only at the Blue Note on Monday, August 26th. Roy Ayers finishes the rest of the week from the 27th to 31st. See bluenote.net for more info. bassist Charnette Moffett will be one night only at the Jazz Standard with his Spirit of Sound Ensemble on Tuesday the 27th with fellow Will Calhoun collaborator pianist Mark Carey. 7:30 and 9:30 shows. See jazzstandard.net for details. And finally, drummer Jeff Tane Watts will appear at the Village Vanguard with his quartet from September 3rd to the 8th. VillageVanguard.com for details on all of those shows. Again, if you missed anything, go to our website and click on the link for the blog, and it will be up there sometime tomorrow, hopefully. And that is it for this week.
Thank you so much, Hank Williams. Oh, here's Michael Carvin. Let's check it out now. You are listening to WBAI New York, 99.5 FM. Shuge Mabol, Michael Carvin is our guest. On drums, master drummer Michael Carvin. Stay tuned for more Shuge Mabol with me, Joyce Jones, and
Hank Williams.
Campbell in 75 when Jackie and Dexter and Kenny Clark and a young drummer by the name of Michael Carvin started Steeplechase Records in Copenhagen.
Okay.
I only made that record because it was an opportunity, but it was like a promise of the future. I wasn't ready to be a leader, but I wanted to plant a seed to say, oh, by the way, this will happen, but not now. So the opportunity was there, so I did it. Now, with Antiquity.
With Jackie McCullough.
Yeah. We were flying to Copenhagen, and Jackie was very upset. And Jackie don't usually get upset. And he said, oh, Michael, I don't want to play with Niels Oscar, the so-and-so, that bass player.
Yeah.
And the piano player, Ulla Matista, I don't want to play with Ulla Matista and Neil. And I'm listening to him, and he's whining and crying. And I say, you Jackie McLean, aren't you? He say, yeah. I say, then you don't have to play with nobody if you don't want to. He said, yeah, but Niels want me to do the record, and, you know, and I don't want to use these guys. I say, then, because by this time I was tired of hearing this. Keep in mind, I'm a Vietnam veteran. So, we're making too much over a record. I mean, it'd be different if we getting shot or something. We don't want to go back at that because they're going to shoot us again. But so I say, Jackie, man, look, man. If you don't want to do it, don't do it. He said, then what are we going to do? I said, let's do a duet record. He said, a duet? I said, yeah. I said, Jackie, look, if this record that you was going to Copenhagen to make was going to be with Philly Joe Jones and all of them cats and Paul Chambers, I said, would nobody listen to it? He said, why? I said, because you have a reputation of making great records. I said, and if you were to make another bebop kind of record, it's just going to fall on deaf ears. I said, you need to stop chasing Charlie Parker. You have done that. I said, let's do a duet record, and you discover Jackie. He got mad at me. He didn't speak to me the rest of the time on the plane to Copenhagen. We got off the plane. He got his bags. He wouldn't ride with me in the car. He demanded another car. And the next morning, he almost broke my door down. At about 4:30 or 5:30, beating on the door, he hollered, open the door, open the door, or open the door. He had written the first song for the duet. He said, now I wrote this, and we're going to start rehearsing every morning at so-and-so. And I say, okay, Jackie, and I mean it. And you know, he was mad. He was mad. But if you go back and check out Jackie's discography, you will find that after the birth of Antiquity, he played that type of music until he died. Because that was Jackie.
He found his voice.
Yeah, that was Jackie. See, because, see, everybody had to start somewhere. But because my father taught me and then let me mimic him, I had my own voice before I realized it. Because I wasn't allowed to play the drums until I could play. So that's a whole nother approach. Now, had he let me raise myself, then I wouldn't have the sound that I have. I wouldn't think the way that I think. I wouldn't have accomplished what I've accomplished. Because I wouldn't have prepared myself at the right age to accomplish things. I had saw Jeannie Bryson, that's Dizzy's daughter. And Jeannie and I, when I was teaching at Rutgers, I taught there for 6 years before I started the Michael Carvin School of Drumming. And I used to see Jeannie all the time, and she said, oh, you know, my dad is Dizzy Gillespie. And I said, yeah, because I can see it in her face. Okay. So we would talk, and she started talking about Dizzy all the time. So I was like, I really hadn't thought about him. You know, I mean, he wasn't one of the names that I'd written down in California, but I knew he was an innovator. This is funny. I love this. This is hilarious. This is hilarious. So I had just gotten a gig with the Great Jazz Trio with Hank Jones and Ray Brown.
Oh.
Yeah. So now Elvin got me the gig because Elvin and I were tight.
Okay.
Because Elvin was with the 82nd Airborne Division, and he's a great rudimental drummer, and I was with the 89th Infantry Division, although Elvin was in the Korean conflict and I was in the Vietnam War. But nevertheless, we both GIs, we both loved the rudimental style of drumming. And I used to train with Elvin. I would get up and come down on 103rd Street in Central Park West, and we would go out in the park and run together, Elvin and I. Yeah, but I never asked any of the masters to teach me anything because I grew up with a drummer and I knew that I didn't need them to teach me anything about how to play some on the drums. I just needed to be around them to see how they maintain their lifestyle with that type of title. That's what I needed. I needed to learn how to behave, how to navigate the seas of New York, because it's different if you ain't from a city. It's a whole other ball game.
Well, I actually have a question with regard to Jackie McLean.
Okay.
Did his way of teaching affect you, or your way of teaching affect him in his, you know, teaching at Rochester?
Yeah. Jack and I was tight for 30 years. Jackie grew up in the streets of New York. Jackie was slipped out of his bedroom and slip out of the apartment and go hear Bird. Jackie learned by sound, by ear. Jackie got into composition and all of that later, but he could. So I can sight read faster than most. See, guys can read changes, chords almost. But when you put in the math, what I call the math, the rhythm, then to be able to see that, that's what guys used to say about me. Like they would say, man, you played the book one time and you sound like you've been with us all your life. That's what I teach my young great drummers, man. You got to learn how to read.
So I'm working with Jackie McLean.
His reading really jumped to a higher level. Yeah. No, don't misunderstand me. Reading and writing before
right.
I met him. But it's different levels of everything.
Right.
But I love Jackie. I dubbed him the Scooter, and that's what I used to call him, Scooter, because he was only 5 years
okay.
old.
Okay.
I mean, if you really know him, he. So I called him Scooter because he... when you really look at him, he looked like a little guy that could be on his little scooter. With his little cap on sideways, you know.
Now, Lonnie Liston Smith.
Yes.
Playing with him. Now, this was something that I thought was really interesting because you basically played percussion with him.
Yes.
And there were several other people playing percussion as well.
Yeah.
And I was just wondering how you found your voice as a percussionist.
Well, see, what happened was the hit record of...
Expansion?
Yeah, Expansion. Now, this is what happened. Lonnie knew that I had done work in California. So Lonnie had just left Miles, and he had gotten this recording contract, and he was transitioning into pop, and he didn't have a clue. So he called me, and I actually helped arrange his music. Now, Lonnie said the reason why he didn't want me to play drums on the date was because I have too much energy.
Right.
Said, and that's the truth.
He said that you were, how did he phrase it?
Too fiery.
Fiery, exactly.
Yeah. Mike, have patience, man. It's too fiery. I said, man, wake up and stop sleeping. Because Lonnie loved to float.
Right.
He liked to get mad float. Liked to float.
Yeah.
So, okay, so we did Expansions. So they put out the record. And for on-air personnel, people like yourself, when a new record come out, you play what you like.
Generally, yeah.
So... Everybody was playing Voodoo Woman.
Oh.
I wrote it.
Oh.
And instead of him saying, I produced the record, he said, well, special, thank Michael for his special. He roughed it off some kind of way instead of saying, I produced it. And I was a little disturbed with him about that, but it was cool. I forgave him. But that's why I didn't play drums. Now, the reason why I played drums on Infinite because I had made that hit record with Doug and Gene Kahn.
Exactly.
And he wanted to do that same arrangement.
Right.
That's why he had the original drummer to do that.
That's
because he was
that.
A big fan of Doug's and Gene. Oh. Right? That was my first jazz record, but it didn't get the exposure. See, I met Doug and Gene. That was a demo date. We didn't get paid for it. That's why Doug never soloed on any of the songs. We were getting the music together, and the guy pushed play.
Wow.
And made that hit record.
Oh, my God.
That's what I say, we were stumbling to success. That record took off in the Black Student Union because all the colleges had that there. And that's what fed us a lot, the Black Student Union, where they could demand who they wanted. So Lonnie had heard that. And so he wanted Donald the same. And that's why he called me for the record to play that particular feeling that he liked from Doug and Gene record and also to bring my commercial value to the date because he didn't know how the beats should hook up because he had been playing jazz and more creative music.
What a joy divine, what a perfect state of mind, with their worries and cares left behind. Oh, what a peaceful joy divine.
what a perfect state of mind, with their worries and cares left behind. Oh, what a peaceful time.
So the guy pulled it back in, the producer, and they made an oversized 45 of expansions. That means now that's all you guys could play.
Right, the single.
And that's how expansions came through. Then they released it. Because on the Black News show here, what was that brother that used to have that Black News television show in New York? Yes.
Okay, the Rich Street Report.
To run the credits, he used Voodoo Woman. As a matter of fact, I just got a check. Lonnie called me. I still talk to Lonnie. I love Lonnie because I understand him. You know, he's a little, I call him an astral traveling child. You heard of Wayne's World?
Yes.
You got to get to Lonnie's World.
Correct.
Serve that client.
The Camel.
Yes.
That was released in 1975.
Right. On Stevie Chase Records.
Yeah.
Yeah, that was just to say promise of the future. Mm-hmm. I'm not really ready to lead a band now, but don't think I won't in time.
So when did you start to feel like you were ready to leave?
When I left Dizzy. See, I went to Europe with Hampton Halls. We were being booked by Simone Ginnebry. I'm 6'2". Henry Franklin is about 6'4". And Hamp was about maybe 5'11". We get to Paris. Simone Ginnebry have us in one room.
Did they have cots?
No.
Oh, no.
Just a regular hotel, bedroom, and bath. Hamp was a sweetheart. And it's my first jazz tour. I've done R&B now. I ain't never slept in no one room with no two other men in no R&B now. I mean, you know, your clothes have a room. So this is my first jazz now. I'm trying to, like, get ready for this now. We're in Paris now. So I said, well, Ham, you take the room because you're the leader. And I say, Henry Franklin was the bass player. I say, Henry and I can wait downstairs until they get the other rooms because we're flown from California to Paris. And Hamp was saying, okay. And then we get downstairs and the lady informed us that there will be no other room. So we tired and it's getting dark, so we took the bed apart. And I said, well, Hamp, won't you sleep on a mattress and Henry sleep on the bed spring? And I slept on the floor in the hallway bathroom. So we didn't see Simone Ginnebry for 3 days, and when we did see her, we were on our way to Germany. And we caught the train because we had Eurail passes, and when we got to Germany, everybody had a room. And every time we came back to Paris, it was one room.
Okay, why was that?
Because I haven't the slightest idea.
Okay.
When I went with Freddie, it was different. When I went with Jackie, it was different. Now, when I went with John Burke Gillespie, it was completely different. It was suites, and it was nights of cars, and it was a complete pleasure, and sometime private planes. We did 4 days with B.B. King. Yeah, this and B.B.
Oh, wow.
And we were on the plane together, right?
Uh-huh.
We was leaving Pori, Finland. We had just finished playing the Pori Jazz Festival. So this is too crazy. We all on the plane waiting on John. So Dizzy had an 18-piece band, and we had the quartet, plus the roadies and the management and all of that stuff. So Dizzy come on the plane, and he has two chickens. Now, where he got them from, I don't know. Cooked, though, and he got them on his arm. So then he said, I got some chicken. Who wants some chicken? So you know our guys are like kids on the road. Yeah, Dizzy. So he's taking the chicken apart, and he's throwing it. Chicken was everywhere, all on the seats. Nobody ate it. guy's missing the chicken and is hitting guys in the head and it's, you know, it's just chicken and grease. Then I met Kenny Clark. See, because Kenny had moved to Paris in the 50s. I'd always wanted to meet Kenny Clark because Kenny Clark was the founder of Bebop Drumming. But because Kenny split, they gave that to Max. So Dizzy says, John Burst Gillespie says, well, you know, Salt Peanuts is a drum lake. He said Kenny Clark wrote it. He heard Kenny play that, and he put the notes to it, so to speak. But see, a lot of things written off a drum lick, a few things. So then I really started getting into Kenny Clark. And Kenny was amazing. Dizzy taught me so much about Kenny Clark. So when I first got in the band and we played Salt Peanuts, I played it in unison, like Max recorded it. Dot, 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 dot. So when you join the great guys, they expect you to know their music. So Dizzy told me we're in Munich, Germany now. It's about 4 o'clock in the morning, and he's in my hotel room, and he's saying, well, you know, Michael, I don't usually say anything to the drummer, but you're not playing that right. I say, that's what Max played. He said, yeah, but that's not right. So he showed me. He said, this is what Kenny Clark played. Bop, bop. Ba 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 ba. I was, that's the same thing I said. I was like, wow, he's playing everywhere you're not playing. He said, yeah, that's the drum part, and that's the way I played it. So I've been in the band maybe almost a year. And we was in Munich, this was during that same time, and I said, John, I have something that I want to tell you, but I don't know how to tell you, so I'm just going to tell you. So he got a little sad. He said, you're not going to quit, are you? I said, no. I said, you have never played a night in Tunisia. And he said, what? I said, you've never played a night in Tunisia because Tunisia's in Africa. And you was influenced by Chana Pozo on Night in Tunisia, and Chana Pozo from Cuba. So you have always played a night in Cuba because of the Cuban 6A clave is not the same as the Africans. I explained it to him, and that's the arrangement that he played for the rest of his life.
And you recorded that on the Marcellus?
Yes. Where it makes the melody longer, and you can actually hear it, and it don't sound rushed. Because with the Chana Pozo, it has that rush kind of Cuban sound, like instead of dagger and dagger and dagger and do do da na na da do do da 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 That's the way we play it. But the tempo is still here. And I use the bass to play my lowest note as though they were hand drum. So on the hi-hat I'm playing. So the bass is playing to give it that. You know, so he said, oh, yeah, oh, yeah, oh, yeah, oh, yeah, oh, yeah, oh, yeah. This is the best, though. We were in Canada, Vancouver. So we coming through customs. So the guards take us into this room. I'm like, what have Dizzy done now? We had been in there for 15 minutes, the whole band. Then the guy finally come in, and he say, where's your work visa and your passport? So I'm like, John, where's your work visa and passport? He said, I don't need no work visa and passport. So the guy said, No, you must have a work visa and passport. And this is
I don't use that.
And the guy looked at him, and Dizzy did this. And he swung up. And then the guy said, "Oh, you a Dizzy Gillespie?" He said, "Yeah, I don't need no." I was like, "Whoa." And he ain't checked nobody else's passport. He apologized. Oh, I'm so sorry, Mr. Gillespie, please. And this and that and that and this. And oh, and Dizzy was smoking in the detention room, and you don't supposed to smoke. I say, "John, don't light your pipe, man." He said, I'm going to have a smoke. I'm like, "John, come on, man." And I'm just saying, jail, it's just jail. You know, the whole band, jail. He light his pipe, and he's smoking his pipe. Sign, no smoking. I'm like, "Oh, okay." Dizzy didn't have no new records out when I was with him. He hadn't made a record in 10 years. Everywhere we got, it was crowded at the airport to meet him, like he was a pop star. And sold out concerts, no record, no none of that. What you be hearing, "Well, you got to have a record. Well, if you don't have it." And I'm sitting there, and I'm looking, and I'm saying, "I never saw this side of it." And I said to myself, "That's what I want to be. I want to be the people's musician." Because that's what he was. And when I left John, I had no choice. I couldn't have been a side man if I wanted to. I had no choice because Dizzy showed me, this is all you have to do. No, you know, because you're dealing with human beings, okay? Music is great.
I understand that the musicians that you're looking for, first they have to have their own voice.
Yeah.
Which apparently is not to find.
Well, you see, that's what I encourage, because that's what Dizzy encouraged, and all of the other gentlemen and also ladies that I had the pleasure of working with. But with the young musicians today, they are a little different because their values are different. I didn't know you could make money playing music, and I didn't care. Because when I started playing music, I didn't have no mortgage, I didn't have no Con Ed. I mean, I was a kid, so I love to play music, and I always will. But guys today want to have huge mechanical royalties checks. I don't blame them. And they want the house, and they want it now. And I'll say I don't blame them, but what I find they fall short with is they don't want to fall in love with the music. It's not that they don't want to. They don't realize that they should because they're young. So how can you not want to do something when you're young and you don't know what you do or don't want to do in the first place? The way I put a band together is different than the way most people put a band together.
How do you do it?
I'll study the person first. I know they don't know what I'm going to ask them to do. I already know. So what I want to know is, who are you? I'm not going to ask you that question. I'm just going to watch you. I don't go to hear them play, because what they playing, they ain't going to play that way with me anyway. And I know they not, because I'm going to force them to go somewhere else without asking them to. I'll lead by example. When I met Jansen, Cinco, the bass player, I was doing a master class at the New School. What I admired about Jansen was when I observed him in the class, he was listening to me, but he wasn't paying attention. So he drew my attention to him. When I would have them to come up and play or something, he would play, though. But he was never there. He was 19. So that told me one thing. He's bored. So he's hearing something else then. So I said, I wonder what he's hearing, because there ain't none of this exciting in him. So I said, "Man, you know, I would like to get with you sometime at my studio, if you would." He said, "Yeah, okay." It wasn't like, "Wow, really?" It was like, "Oh." I said, "Well, can I have your number?" "Oh, my number. Oh." You know, like, "Oh, is that what you have to do for me to get in touch? I have to give you my number?" And I mean, he was like, "Do you have a pencil?" And I'm like, "No, but I'll get one." "Oh, okay." I say I like him because he had something on his mind. So he's hearing something. So he came by, he brought his bass, and we started playing. And he was into Ron Carter, so I said, well, look, man, thanks for reminding me of Ron Carter. You can leave now, and I'm going to call him for the record date. Although I didn't have no record date, but he was like, what? That was the first response I ever got out of him. Well, how did I do that? I said, because you're trying to play like him.
Right.
I said, you from the Philippines, right? He said, yeah. I said, do you have your American citizenship papers yet? He said, no. I say, good. I say, play with the Philippine sound to you. And he started playing, and then I accompanied him. And we played, and then I told him, that's the way you play with me, because that's what you know. And we met for about 6 months, because I have to teach young musicians how to hear the drums and what to listen for, because the instrument is large. I don't hear drummers keeping time. I just hear the music has a pulse. Now, like I explained to Jansen, I can strike the drums and I cannot get a sound as low as your bass. So I say, you're the lowest sound in the band. You dominate, because the audience is going to hear the lower frequency if they want to hear it or not. Because the drums is going to enter through the audience's ear. The bass enter through the stomach. Because most young bass players, if you check them out, they play from the middle to the high register, like it's a cello or something. They don't play the root, the bottom. So once a young bass player get into his high register, he robs my ride cymbal sound because it washes out. Now, Keith Loftus, the tenor player, Keith had came from Dallas to go to school, and I met him one day. I was finished teaching at my school on 9th Avenue at the Film Center building. And he said, oh, Mr. Garvin, how you doing? Yeah, boom, boom, boom. I'm Keith Loftus. I'm from Dallas, Texas. I said, great, man. What you doing? He said, well, I'm going to school. I said, well, great, man. I said, I'm going to keep my eye on you, because I just dug his energy. I decided, I said, well, when Des Ron Douglas and Carlton Holmes had been with me for 20 years. Carlton, piano player. And Marcus Strickland. Yeah. I dug them, but they were individual.
Marcus is tenor sax, okay?
Tenor, yeah. They want to be band leaders. Yeah, I don't blame them. So they were never in a moment of sharing the sound and the feeling of the composition. They wanted to be recognized, and rightfully so. I mean, everybody deserve to be recognized. But Jansen, being from the Philippines and being in a different frame of mind with his thinking, because he's not from this country, and then Keith coming from Dallas and more interested in sound and more interested in a band community. So I had Keith. Keith came by for about 6 months. Just Keith. I would see Jansen on one day and see Keith on a different day. I wouldn't bring them in together. And I taught Keith how to listen to the ride cymbal, because he have to actually ride my ride cymbal as a surfboard. I say, you have to sing. So I told him, I say, go and listen to Carmen McRae. Now, piano players is my left hand. So anytime there's a piano player in the band, because I played a long time without a piano, because every piano player I used, they kept robbing my left hand. I was talking to Jansen. I say, Jansen, I'm looking for a piano player, but I want somebody like you that is in a different mind space. So he say, do you mind if it's a female? I said, no. So he say, okay, I'm going to have somebody to call you. I said, okay. So he had this nitty-bitty voice to call me. Oh, Mr. Carmen, no. Oh, my name is Yayoi Kawa. I say, I love you already. I said, yeah. So I had her to come by and see me. Well, I went to a studio where they had a piano. So she's nervous and, oh, do you have the music? I said, I didn't bring no music. I said, how long have you been in New York? She said, 10 years. I said, oh, really? I said, do you miss Tokyo? She said, yeah. I said, play it for me. And when she played it, I could hear Japan. And she stopped playing. I said, no, just play it. And as she got more and more into it, I started playing with her. So she could see, like, not only am I listening to you and I'm not trying to lead you, but we're playing together. But nothing is written and we ain't have no verbal discussion, but we're talking about everything musically. Keith Loftus told me something once that I just never thought about. He said, Carmen, man, when you told me to be free, he said, I didn't know what you were talking about. He said, man, that was profound the first time you told me to play me. He said, what school teach you to play you? I mean, but I never thought about it, because I know that that's what you're going to have to end up doing. you just heard us at the concert.
Mm-hmm.
What did you take from it?
I took that the Michael Carvin experience was a wonderful unit, that you sounded as a group.
Mm-hmm.
You sounded
mm-hmm.
like
mm-hmm.
a group.
Mm-hmm.
You
mm-hmm.
all fit.
Mm-hmm. Which
with
is
each
unusual
other.
Today. Yeah.
Well, but if that made yes. it more pleasurable to
yeah.
even enjoy all
yeah.
of you because
yeah.
you all work
yeah.
well.
Yeah, it's just like I was saying about that was Freddie Hubbard's first band. This is my first band. Just like I was in Freddie's band. Because these are unheard of.
Now, you mentioned Rhonda Hamilton earlier.
Mm-hmm.
Rhonda Hamilton is your...
That's my beautiful bride.
Yes. Exactly. I was just going to... I've seen you reference her as your beautiful bride.
Yes, well, she is.
Well, I understand your beautiful bride is the person responsible for your being involved in the project with Billy Bang, the Vietnam project?
Yeah, Hannah Blewett. That was very interesting. Blewett was working with this trio, Billy Bang and a hand percussionist. They had a record on Just in Time, and they were touring, right? So... Billy Bang is saying, oh, man, the record company's going to let me do my Vietnam project, but I need a drummer. I don't know a drummer to use. So Blewett say, what are you talking about? He said, man, Michael Carvin, not only he's a great drummer, but he's a Vietnam veteran. But see, that's how New York is. See, I have been moving on the Dizzy Gillespie, Hank Jones, Ray Brown, Jackie McLean, Freddie Hubbard circuit, and he was moving on another circuit, and I never met them. But I had made 3 records with Blewett. So when Bang called me, he was like, oh, man, I'm glad that you agreed to do it. I said, well, I didn't agree to do it. I agreed to come and meet you, but I was a little skeptical because I have avoided all of the Vietnam type of, I don't deal with that Memorial Day stuff. I don't be dealing with none of that. So I was like, well, I don't know. So I was talking to Rhonda about it. I said, well, I don't know. She said, well, go and check it out. I mean, and I said, well, I don't know if I want to be around veterans. And I didn't really know if I wanted to be around that because I made it my business not to. So Bang and I had lunch together. I called him up. I said, well, let me take you to lunch. I like to take people to lunch. I just don't like, I'll come play. So Bang is hilarious. He's funny. I mean, and he don't know it. He don't know it because he be trying to be serious, but Bang is, he's funny to me, but Billy Bang was a genius. And you know, we just talked and he told me he went to prep school and all of this and all of that. So I said, okay, because I'd worked with the Fiddler. So I was telling him that I'd done some stuff with Big J McShann and the Fiddler with the 18-piece band. And he was saying, oh, yeah, man, the Fiddler and this and that. So I told him, okay, I'll come to a rehearsal and let's take one day at a time. So I came home and Rhonda said, well, how was it? I said, the guy's really funny. She said, see, I knew you were like it. I said, well, I'm going to go, and then we have to play the music. And the music was unbelievable. Thank you. them. The music. After the first eight bars of, I think was Yo Ho Chi Minh or what, whatever tune he pulled up first, and I read it because I can sight read. And he was really impressed with my musicianship. And so we got out there, and then I met Ted. But see, I had saw Ted with the 25th Infantry Division. Well, Ted saw me. I came up to play coup to see a friend of mine that was with the 25th, and he wasn't around the compound. So Ted said, man, I remember when you came up to play coup to see one of your buddies, and he wasn't there. I said, well, you must know because that was me. He said, yeah, man. So then I'm saying, wow. Then
that's Ted Daniel, by the way.
Ted Daniel. So then, of course, I knew Dr. Too Much because I met Dr. Too Much in San Francisco.
I'm sorry, Dr. Too Much?
Yeah. Frank Lowe.
Okay.
That's Dr. Too Much. Now, Frank. I met Frank when I moved to San Francisco. One day I was out for, I told you, in San Francisco, I would go for my walk. So I'm walking, and I see this guy coming down Haight Street, and I notice that he's wearing a Russian Chinese hat, green hat with a red star on it. So it's a different kind of brother. He was on the opposite side of the street. I'm coming up the hill, and he's coming down here. But I could tell he was a character. So as he got near, I crossed over to his side of the street. I said, man, what's happening, brother? He said, hey, man, what's happening? I said, why are you wearing that communist cap, man? He said, well, why not? I said, okay. He said, what's your name? I said, Michael Carlin. You say the drummer? I said, yeah. He said, man, I'm Frank Lowe. I said, hey, Frank, man, how you doing, man? So he said, man, let's get together and play sometime. I said, cool. He said, I'm going to work now. He drove a trolley. So he was walking down to Market Street where they turn around to go to work to get his trolley. So he gave me his number, so I called him, and he used to come by. He wasn't Dr. Too Much then. He was Frank Lowe. But he was working on it. So the next time I see him, he called me and said, Colin. I said, yeah. He said, man, Alice Coltrane just called me. I'm going to New York. I said, whoa, wow, man. Good luck. So he split. And 3 years later, I came, but I never saw him because I was in that other circle. When I ran across him in the band, boy. So here it is, Dr. Too Much, John Hicks, and Curtis Lundy. So I'm saying, okay, so we got four veterans and two civilians. So Bang said, well, call me, man. I really want Sonny Fortune to do today. I said, well, I'll call him because I had given Sonny gigs when I lived in L.A. When he came to L.A. in 1968 or 69, when he had left Mungo's band, he was trying to hang out in L.A., but he got a little impatient and said, man, I'm going back to New York, and left, and he came back and joined the court. I view Sonny on the camera. And the reason why I called Sonny, because he had worked in my band in California. Billy was really impressed, and that's when Billy and I really got to be tight, because he said, well, this guy can take me to another playing situation. Because Billy was qualified, but it just that Billy really kind of started looking up to me. But music, and when we would play, it would get to that other place. I remember we was at Monterey Jazz Festival. So we played Bang solo first. So Ted was taking his time building this thing. And then Ted, it was one of them nights where we locked into the magic. John and Curtis and Ted and I. Bang was always locked in because it was his band and he would push so hard. But Ted is a different personality. Ted fooled around and hit some, and it like pushed the button in the rhythm section. And we just all took off, so started getting bigger and bigger and bigger. And Bang turns around and said, Michael, come back. Michael, come back. Don't go out. Don't go out. Michael, come back. Don't go out. So afterwards, when we finished playing, I say, how dare you? You the out to lunch bunch by yourself. You a bunch. What is a bunch? 12 or 14 or something? We get ready to light it up, and you talking about come back, don't go out. I said, you must be out of your mind. So afterwards, Dr. Too Much was saying, yeah, you know, Bang got a little nervous. But what a band, man. That was a band. The music that Billy Bang wrote and that we had the honor to perform with him, one day, hopefully, somebody will check it out. every time we played, it was packed.
And actually, I noticed how you're playing on it, how you use the cymbals was magical. I mean, it just...
Yeah. We were just in it. But to use the dog tag numbers, that was my idea. Yeah.
And I noticed in the aftermath, you provided a photo of yourself back then.
Yeah. That was from, I was in the field waiting on the airlift. Yeah, that was with my M14, I think. Yeah. That don't look nothing like me, does it?
It does. Well, you have facial hair in the picture, so. And glasses.
No, I ain't got nothing to do with that. That don't look nothing like me.
It's like, well, you're a changed internal person.
Yeah, man. I was 20 years old. 19 or 20, yeah. Yeah, we were all kids now.
I understand that they picked you up. You were gigging.
I was at the Playboy Club in New York. And I was staying at the Wellington again. Yeah. They came to the gig, and that was during the days when I was cute and cocky. And they came and said, the two agents in suits and ties on the break, they said, Michael Carvin. And I said, yes, would you like my autograph? And they put handcuffs on me and took me back to the Wellington, from the Wellington to my home in Houston, Texas, although I was living in California. Dropped my suitcase off, my drums off at my parents' house, took me to the airport, the MPs put the handcuffs on me, they flew me to Fort Benning, Georgia. The next morning, I was in it. I couldn't believe it. It took me about almost a week to realize I'd been drafted. I mean, it was like one world to another. But I got it together. See, I never lose. I got Article 15 the first day.
What's that?
It's like a small court martial. And I cursed out the sergeant. He looked at my weapon and he said, you got enough dirt in the barrel to grow potatoes. And he took it and he threw it under the barracks. So I left it. And so he said, go under there and get that weapon and clean it. I said, you threw it under there and you go under there and get it. He said, you're going to get Article 15. I said, I don't care what I get. You threw it under there. It's government issue. If you want it, you go under there and get it. I'm not going. So I didn't go. So he took me to see the first sergeant, and the first sergeant said, well, look, private, just because you tell the truth, it's not going to make things any easier. I said, I could care less. He threw it under there. If he don't go get it, it'll stay there, and I'm through with it. So, of course, he didn't give me an Article 15. So that was a little second lieutenant out of West Point, and we would go to the PT field every morning, the physical training field. And he couldn't call cadence. I mean, he would say, attention, and we would look at him like, are you kidding me? I mean, we all draft these. I mean, it was like the dirty dozen, just 500 of us. And we were like, are you kidding me? Attention, get out of here, man. So I'm on the PT field. And here's this sergeant standing up on the platform. Good morning, man. And his stomach is hanging off his belt. So everybody jumping down, exercising, out of about 250 guys. I'm standing there. He said, what's your problem, soldier? Get down and give me 10. And I just looked at him. So he jumped off the thing and ran down there. Didn't you hear me? You know, get into your face. And I said, look, man, I refuse to train from a person that is not fit to teach me. So he said, I'm going to give you an Article 15. I said, I can care less. So now I'm back in front of the first shirt again. He said, private. He said, what I'm going to do with you? I said, look, I refuse to train from a person that is not in shape, and I'm not going to do it. His name was Sergeant Fitch. I'll never forget it. Fitch Joe. We called him Fitch. He said, well, what did you do in civilian life? I said, I was a very successful drummer. He said, oh, you're a musician, huh? He said, what did you do before then? Because you have a different attitude. I said, well, I was a drum captain in high school. He said, oh, you're a leader. I said, yeah. He said, okay, as of right now, you are corporal. He said, so you get your stuff out your bunk, move to the private room upstairs. So I got my stuff because I was sleeping on the main floor with everybody on the bottom of the countertop. I moved upstairs. I had my own room. And on the door, he had it up there when I got up at 0600 hours the next morning, said, Corporal Carvin. So I started leading the guys to the PT field. I started calling the cadence because I was a drum captain and I could do that. Then that's when I realized if I start fighting as some soldier, I win. And one day, Sergeant Fish told me, he said, man, why won't you go to OCS school? I said, what is that? He said, Officers Candidate School. I say, will I still get out in 2 years? He say, no. I said, well, I ain't going there. He say, you would make a fine officer. I say, but I'll make a great drummer. I say, I'll go if I don't have to stay no longer than 2 years. So he say, well, study hard in your classes. And I say, I will, because he knew I was going to Vietnam. He didn't say it, but he say, just make sure you study hard in your classes and keep on leading. I say, okay. And I got there. Then I went to Fort Polk, Louisiana for guerrilla warfare training. I left there, and we went to Fort Lewis, Washington, and then I got on the U.S. Buckner with 25 other 100 men, and we had a convoy from Seattle, Washington to Vietnam. So one day I went into Saigon to go to an ammo dump to get some ammo. So I hear these guys playing. So I say, man, let me go over here and see what they doing. I could hear the drums, because drums always carry in the wind, and they had a jazz quintet playing. So the drummer, I'll never forget, named Joyce Aranovich from Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. I said, man, can I sit in? He said, can you play? I said, yeah, but I ain't played in 6 months. He said, well, sit in. So I sat in, and after that, I'd never lose anything. He said, look, man, I'm getting ready to ETS back to the States in 2 weeks. And then he said, can you read? I said, of course I can read. He said, well, why don't I introduce you to the warrant officer? And instead of them sending over a drummer from the States, you can take my place in the band. 3 days later, I was in special service. Whole nother world. I mean, whole nother world. Just like that. And that's when I said, wow, life is very interesting.
A whole other world, how?
I was only in the Army because I had a uniform on. We were General Westmoreland's private band. When Westmoreland gave parties, we played for it. We wasn't a post band, get up in the morning and play parades. We had an 18-piece dance band. We was what you call permanent TDY. My job was to practice.
Wow, that's it.
In the Army band, your job is to practice. In the Army infantry, your job is to kill. So my whole world changed. But if we didn't have no gigs, and if you had $100, you could leave country, what they call TDY. You can be temporarily off duty. Yes.
So the Michael Carvin Experience, do you have anything planned? Are you recording?
The next gig that we are going to do in New York, you know, they have that 90-day thing here.
What's that?
Well, after you perform, you can't perform again for 90 days.
No, I didn't know that.
Yeah, in order to work certain rooms.
Okay.
Not just to work anywhere.
Okay.
You can play, but the certain rooms, which I like. So the next time the band will play in Manhattan will be December 13th and 14th at Jazz at Catano's.
Okay.
38th Street and Park Avenue. Yeah.
And do you plan to record?
The new record, the band have already recorded. We recorded in May. The new record is coming out the second week of February, 2014. I really like this band. And that's why I refer to them as the band. And if you notice, I've never said I or my, because it isn't. I'm the drummer in the band. That's all. I happen to be the leader, but I'm not leading the music. I'm playing the drum part, and Keith playing the tenor part. Jansen is playing the bass part. Yayo is playing the piano part. And that's the bottom line. We are building this from nothing to something, and that's a band. And before it's over with, there'll be household name. Just by you, George, merely having me on your show, and thank you so much.
Well, I got to say, I am grateful that you said yes. And so we are happy that you joined us on Sugar in My Bowl. Now, there's one last thing I want to mention.
Okay.
The documentary.
Mm-hmm.
Documentary that let's see, No Excuses.
Yeah, Oscar Sanders is the producer. Yeah.
Do you know what the progress is on that one? Or
our date is for 2014. We're gonna launch that and the CD. We are going to create an explosion. Yeah.
Well, thank you so much, Michael Carvin, for joining Sugar My Bowl.
You're more than welcome, George Jones. You're more than welcome. Thank you so much.
I feel so bad talking over this right now. But we need to get ready to get out of here. You have been listening to Sugar in My Bowl. My name's Joyce Jones, and my associate producer,
Hank Williams.
And we are getting ready to get out of here and make room for La Nueva Alternativa, but I thought I'd let you know very quickly that what you're listening to right now is from the Vietnam Reflections, Billy Bang. Billy Bang on violin, Ted Daniel on trumpet, James Spaulding on alto, saxophone, and flute, Henry Threadgild on flute, John Hicks on piano, Curtis Lundy on bass, Ron Brown on percussion, Nan No on Dan Trang, and Michael Carvin on drums. It's a 2005 Just in Time Records. Before that, we heard Yo, Ho Chi Minh is in the house. Billy Bang from Vietnam, the Aftermath. That's one where there's a photo and the dog tag numbers. And let's see, that's Billy Bang on violin, Ted Daniels on trumpet, Frank Lowe, the late Frank Lowe on tenor saxophone, Sonny Fortune on flute, John Hicks on piano, Curtis Lundy on bass, Ron Brown on percussion, Michael Carvin on drums, 2001 Just in Time release. And before that, A Night in Tunisia, Michael Carvin from the Marsalis Music Honors series. Michael Carvin on drums, Desron Douglas on bass, Carlton Holmes on piano, Marcus Strickland on alto and tenor saxophone. That was released in 2006 on Marsalis Music Rounder Records. And before that, we heard two versions of Peace. Peace from Infant Eyes. Doug Karn and Gene Karn. And then we heard Lonnie Liston Smith's version of Peace from Expansions. The Doug Karn release was released in on Black Jazz Records in 1974, and Flying Dutchman for Expansions, Lonnie Liston Smith, in 1975. Before that, we heard Jackie McLean and Michael Carvin from Antiquity, Down in the Bottom. And that's a 1974 Steeplechase Records release. And like I said, coming up next is La Nueva Alternativa. Stay tuned for more on WBAI New York. We'll be back. I don't know who we're going to present next time, but we'll be back. Good night, Hank Williams.
Good night, Joyce Jones. Good night, everyone.
Stay tuned.
Hello, bueno, this is Sonia Sanchez. I urge you to give your generous support to listener-sponsored community radio, WBAI 99.5 FM in New York.